Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Thought I'd share with you an anecdote from today's practice. Many of you probably don't know that I actually also am an acupuncturist. And I've been doing that since the late 90s because after 10 years of practicing medicine, I got very, very tired of writing prescriptions for opioids. Now, don't get me wrong, they have their place. And I think I have a good proportionate sense for when they're appropriate. And there are situations where that is the best and only solution. However, it isn't the only solution, and I wanted more options, so I learned acupuncture and became a pain specialist, specializing in people with quote-unquote failed back surgeries and failed neck surgeries. And over the years, I've learned a great deal about acupuncture, including the fact that you don't have to use needles. The reason I was reminded of this is that a patient came back to me today. He's someone who I've taken care of, I think the last time I saw him was 2012. And he told me that I haven't seen you for a while because everything's been going great. And the last time I was in, I had a problem that you said you could fix with acupuncture. And I said, well, I don't like needles. And you, Dr. Dawn, said, well, that's okay. I have tuning forks. And indeed, tuning forks, particularly if they're tuned to the proper frequencies, are a very adequate substitute for needles. And in fact, that's all I use with children because children are fascinated with tuning forks and, well, as you might expect, frightened by needles. It turns out that just about any energy, whether it's physical energy, heat energy, magnetic energy, electrical energy, or, and by the way, that's how acupuncture needles work. There are two different metal alloys. You're in a room that's probably got a temperature of 70. Your body has a temperature of, 98. And between the temperature gradient and the two metals, you get a tiny little flow of electricity into the acupuncture point. And the physical movement of the needles kind of gets it rolling, but then just the gradient of those metals and that temperature gradient keeps it rolling. And voila, we have therapy. Acupuncture can be used for a great variety of things you wouldn't expect, like allergies, pain, of course, as I've already mentioned, but also digestion issues, kidney stones, gallstones. I've definitely gotten people to pass gallstones and kidney stones using the acupuncture needles. I've also started labor. There are some points, in fact, that you don't want to use ever in a pregnant woman unless she's ready to deliver. So let me give out those numbers again. They are 900-5773. And I'm going to start with a science article about acupuncture. And this one was a randomized, controlled, double-blind study, or as blind as you can get with acupuncture needles. But, you know, I don't really think it matters that much whether the patient knew they were being treated, because the things that were being measured were kind of like, if the placebo effect can fix this, I'm all down with the placebo effect, because the endpoints in this study were tumor size and an increase in the number of natural killer cells. And these are the cells that fight cancer, that drop when a person's on chemotherapy, which is one of the problems. We give you a drug that kills your cancer, but it also kills your cancer-fighting cells. So this study looked at a very simple, and I do mean simple, acupuncture protocol. And for those of you who are acupuncturists, they just treated stomach 36, and they simply did electroacupuncture for one day, bilateral stomach 36, that's it, no big deal. It was a relatively small study, and that's important because it had a very large treatment effect, which means it's real, okay? With 44 patients, 22 women with stage 2 to 3 locally advanced cervical cancer, One group got the usual chemotherapy, and it was the same for the whole 44 patients. Half of them got randomly put into the acupuncture group. They had the stomach 36 treatment, and the stomach 36 treatment patients after each chemotherapy cycle, so that's once a week, had a very, very significant increase in the number of natural killer cells, and the P on that was P.001. That is super highly significant. And a significant decrease in tumor size, not quite such a big effect, P equals 0.03, but still well within the realm of significance. And remember, these things are blood tests and magnetic resonance imaging. So that is a very, very reliable and accurate way to measure tumor size. And over the course of the chemo, there were four cycles only. The people who were in the treatment group with acupuncture also had a significant decrease in nausea. A non-significant decrease in nausea, but a significant increase in appetite. So it didn't help vomiting and it didn't help nausea, although if I'd been in charge of that treatment, I would have used more needles and probably would have been successful, because there are other studies showing that you can reduce both postoperative nausea and chemo nausea with acupuncture. But I wanted to share the study with you, published in a peer-reviewed journal, and a study which shows substantial significance of electroacupuncture in increasing the number of cancer-fighting cells and decreasing the number of tumors. Let me just talk for a moment about CBD. Now, we've heard about CBD oil and CBD and THC. That's been very much in the news. But cannabidiol is the non-intoxicating form of marijuana. It's found in hemp oil. It's legal. Now everything, of course, is legal, but this one's even legal in states where THC is not. One of the ways that CBD works is it actually slows down the breakdown of the body's own natural cannabinoids. So it is helping you hold on to your calming and pain control neurotransmitters, the ones you've got on your own. I am using a lot of CBD now that the lid is off on that. And today I recommended it to a patient who had a persistent itch. If you haven't tried it for itching, give it a shot. I have found that CBD oil and ointment is remarkably good for itching. It seems to shut it right down. I haven't tried it on bee stings, but I have a patient working on that right now because he came in with some bee stings that were itching. It does work on mosquito bites, so I have high hopes that my N of one study is going to show that that also is effective. We're going to go now to Elizabeth. Are you there? Have we got you?
Hey, Dr. Don.
Hi.
Glad to see your show back.
Thank you.
On your old show, you once told me a great remedy for spring allergies, and with all the beautiful rain we've had, which I just love, I'm trying to prepare for what spring might be like. And you had, I'm trying to remember this remedy you mentioned about, I think it was involving some, maybe some nasal cromolin or something. There was some over-the-counter thing, and I think a homeopathic thing.
Yes.
I'm trying to remember, but maybe you even have something more up to date that you could share with everyone.
Very, very, very much so.
Do you remember anything that it's good to
actually
share?
My advice is often fairly stereotyped, so even though I don't remember your call from whenever, it's these are really standard things that I share with people. So, first of all, there's kind of two versions of allergies. There's a sneezy, runny nose, and that one you don't need to wash your nose out. But when things start to get stuffy and congested and you feel like you've constantly got a cold, then you need to start thinking about washing your nose out with saline, because that really clears out the persistent allergens. It's kind of a cascade. The pollen gets in there. You have these cells called mast cells, and on them are recognition antibodies called IgE, which are primed to attach to that pollen. And when they attach, they bend the mast cell because there's multiple on the surface. And when they attach the pollen, the mast cell bends. That causes an electrical cascade within the mast cell, and it releases these little things full of, oh, great, histamine. So these little baggies, if you will, full of histamine and a couple of other things, including leukotrienes, the slow-reacting substance of anaphylaxis, we used to call it. And that second one, the leukotrienes, they hang around forever. And so that's why if you get into the stuffy situation, you need to rinse and get rid of, you're actually rinsing out those leukotrienes. But histamine's a pretty short-acting thing and gets broken down fairly quickly. But while it's around, it causes your capillaries to leak and hence the runny nose. And it also, in that little baggie, is something called bradykinin, which is when you hurt yourself and you have pain. The bradykinin is a pain signal, but it also causes you to sneeze because it's an irritant. So I like to stabilize the mast cells. And you mentioned Cromolyn, which is a very effective pharmaceutical. You can buy it over the counter. It's called nasal chrome. And its only drawback, because it is extremely safe, is that you have to keep using it. So you're carrying a little sprayer around and hitting your nose probably three times a day, maybe four times a day, if you don't get ahead of it. If you can get ahead of it before your allergy season hits, then usually twice a day will do the trick and keep those mast cells from releasing the histamine and starting the whole cascade. The other thing I really like is a plant-derived compound, a plant alkaloid called quercetin, and that's spelled Q-U-E-R-C-E-T-I-N. Quercetin you can take up to about 3,000 milligrams. That's 3,000, so 3 grams. It's available as capsules or powder. I've never put it in my smoothie. I put a lot of things in my smoothie and grind up the capsules, but I've never tried that in a smoothie. I'll have to give it a shot sometime. But the main thing on this is that it takes about 3 to 7 days to work. So again, getting ahead of the allergies by, oh yes, I was miserable last March. Well, it's time to start taking this. And between the quercetin as a preventative and the Cromolyn as a preventative, you almost never need to resort to an actual antihistamine, which I like because I'm all about keeping your brain happy. And there are some studies that equate antihistamine use. These are studies in Europe where all of the drugs are paid for. And I'm not going into the political discussion, but if all the drugs are paid for it and they have a centralized system, they can track your drug use. So they know how many antihistamines you take in your life and how often you take them. And what they found is after the age of 60, the more antihistamines you take, the more likely you are to develop dementia. Now, that's correlation. That's not cause. We don't know if that's a cause. I'd rather not use antihistamines if I don't have to, because I'm not sure it isn't a cause. You see what I'm saying?
Interesting, yes.
So I like to keep those antihistamines down and use quercetin and the nasochrome. And I actually, if all else fails, I'll use nasal steroids, which are now over the counter, before I use regular antihistamines.
Oh, interesting. Are those something that you can just ask for over the counter, or do they have a certain name?
Well, you mean the nasal steroids?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Flonase is one brand, and I think there's also Beconase that's over the counter now. But beclomethasone and fluticasone are the generic names of those agents, and you will probably find the store brand similar to Flonase advertised. I know I've seen it at Costco, at their little pharmacy, which, by the way, you do not need a prescription. You do not need a Costco card to get your prescription filled at Costco. And if you're having to buy your drugs, it's a good bet that they'll be cheaper.
Thank you, Dr. Don. I hope this helps a lot of people. I think it may.
I think it's certainly a very timely call, Elizabeth.
Yeah.
And thank you so very much for listening to KSQUID.
Definitely.
Bye bye.
Bye.
See, I was just going to stop for a moment and launch back into my discussion of speaking about supplements. So it's a multi-million-dollar industry, actually a multi-billion-dollar industry. Big Pharma is jealous. big business is buying up the supplement industry. One of my favorite supplement companies, Pure Encapsulations, which had good value, high quality products, was just purchased by a major conglomerate called Nestle. You may have heard of them. They did some fairly dodgy things around formula in developing nations a few years ago. Well, more like two decades ago, but that makes me sad because now I have a conflict. And I also will have to watch very carefully if I do continue to recommend these products that their quality doesn't deteriorate. So that is just something that I'm putting out there. It's in the natural health world. But that being said, that's really the point. It's all about sourcing when you talk about supplements. You need to be concerned about contamination. And many supplements contain products that are imported from countries that have very high pollution rates, such as China. And we do have to worry about the plants concentrating the lead that's in the soil or the lead that's raining down on them because of the coal-fired power plants, and whether or not the levels of lead in the powdered version of that plant are high enough to be dangerous for us. Ideally, we'd like a zero tolerance on that. And to do that, that would mean that every bag or every barrel of product that came from outside of the United States or maybe even within the United States would need to be checked for contamination. And that's what I would I like to see in a product. But if they can't do that, and certainly in high volume companies, it's really impossible for them to do that. What you want is surveillance. The company needs to be responsible and have an independent outside laboratory, something like the way that you used to only buy Christmas lights that were certified by Underwriters Laboratory. And you did that because you didn't want your house burning down. And UL would check the things and say, yeah, this is has a good quality profile. It's not going to short out. Well, that's kind of how it is in the world of supplements. There are multiple independent companies, at least a half a dozen of them, and they make their money by accepting a fee and testing the product. So, and then certifying it as contaminant-free. And they get audited by each other. And I do not believe the fix is in. I actually believe that this is a good free market surveillance method, and the libertarians would be very proud of it because it's all free market and private, which is supposed to be the cure for everything. But surveillance is really key. If you're going to be buying a product that's new to you and isn't being vouched for by your provider, I recommend that you call the 800 number or go to the website and ask for a certificate of purity. If they can't give you one right away in a turnaround, then go find a different product. So they're not all the same, especially if there are multiple components. And so those are two concerns. And then when I'm looking at supplements, I will weaponize nutrients. So I will use 300 milligrams of niacin to treat elevated LPA in a patient who has heart cardiac disease risk factors. I'll do that. And that's, 3,000 more than the minimum daily requirement, at least 3,000 more, probably more like 30,000 more. And when you're giving so much more than the nutritional limit, it's not a nutrient anymore. You're using it as a drug. And when I use something as a drug that's a nutraceutical, I want there to be data. I want to know what the side effects are. In the case of super high dose niacin, we know that because this is also a pharmaceutical. And in high dose niacin, we're talking about hepatitis. We're talking about a bad interaction with statins that can cause that rhabdomyolysis, which is where your muscles start to break open and dump myoglobin into your bloodstream, and that can kill your kidneys. So this is not something you do on your own, folks. This is something you do under guidance. When you're doing it on your own, you want to look and see what the highest levels that are achievable by plausible dietary consumption. So for example, if I'm giving a broccoli extract, I'll stop at the equivalent of what you could achieve with eating 5 cups of broccoli a day. No one on the planet is going to eat more than 5 cups of broccoli a day. But if you were a mono broccoli eater, you wouldn't poison yourself with that much broccoli. Potentially, by the way, you could give yourself a goiter because that much broccoli might actually interfere with iodine absorption, but that's about it, and that would be a reversible problem. So again, with broccoli extracts, you don't have the goiterogens. Those have been removed, and so I'm happy using high doses that that match what you could possibly get in nature. So with vitamin D, this is being given widely now by conventional doctors, and that's great because before they were afraid to use it. But I don't agree with using 50,000 units once a week because that's not humanly possible to achieve. You could achieve 10,000 if you went out and spent the entire day in the sun without sunscreen and you had a good base of tan so you didn't burn yourself to a crisp. You could make about 10,000 units of vitamin D in your skin. So my logic is, okay, if the body can handle 10,000 units from sun, it's likely it can handle 10,000 units as a supplement. So I'm going to draw the line there for how I give it. Same thing with iodine. Iodine is an agent that used to be, and when we talk about weaponizing a nutrient, back in the 1920s and 1930s, iodine was like a cure-all, kind of the bulletproof coffee of its day. It was supposed to fix everything. And iodine was given at, 30, 40, 50 milligram doses. I don't like to give more than what can be achieved in a known diet, as I've said. And that's around 8 to 10 milligrams a day. And there are people in Japan who eat a diet that's very high in seaweed, and particularly fermented seaweed, and they will get about 8 to 10 milligrams of iodine a day. So I kind of draw the line there and say, all right, that's plausibly safe. We'll watch for side effects, but I don't think I'm going to give someone hepatitis or shut down their normal thyroid with that kind of dose. And by the way, I don't know if you all remember Fukushima, but when Fukushima happened, I was stocking up on iodine because if there was going to be an airburst and there was going to be a fallout cloud, I was going to make sure that myself, my family, and my patients had stunned their thyroid with high dose iodine so that it couldn't absorb any radioactive iodine. And this is the standard first aid in the event of a nuclear strike, which I'd like to say that was implausible or unlikely. It's not as unlikely here on the West Coast as I would like, but look on the bright side, it's a great deal less likely than it was in the 1980s when Reagan and Gorbachev were playing chicken. We're going to take an email from Sybil. And I don't know where Sybil is, but she wants to know about strontium. And she says, 10 years ago, a company called Garden of Life launched a product called GrowBone that contained calcium, magnesium, vitamin D, vitamin K, vitamin C, boron, silica, and vanadium in one bottle, and a second bottle that contained 680 milligrams of strontium citrate. They told the customers who had a DEXA scan and who demonstrated either osteopenia or osteoporosis to keep all the receipts and after 2 years get another DEXA scan, and if it's not better, they would refund the entire 2 years of products plus pay for the DEXA scan. And so her DEXA scan was a little low, so she took it for 2 years, had another one, and it had normalized. She's been taking the product ever since, but now she's seen a warning from American Bone Health saying strontium citrate is different from ranulate, which was the one that was tested in Europe, and has not been shown to be safe and effective. And they talk about perhaps the potential for heart attacks through hardening of the arteries and maybe even blood clots. The blood clots are news to me, and so I haven't had a chance to chase that down. I did do a quick search, but I couldn't find any articles. But what is interesting about this is another website said strontium increases fracture risk. Well, how could that be if it increases bone density? And the answer there is that our instrument, the bone scanner, is scanning how dense the bone is. In other words, how much of an X-ray beam gets sucked up. but it isn't necessarily telling us about whether the bone is just denser or whether it's stronger. Turns out that there may be a difference. So bone scans were all designed, and all of the thresholds and everything was based on people who weren't being treated. And then we invented treatments, and the treatments showed that they increased bone density. But I never recommended any of the treatments until they showed that they decreased bone fracture. So unfortunately, the strontium ranulate, which appears to be effective, and the strontium citrate may not be the same thing. They may not be comparable. Even though the strontium citrate may deposit in the bone, we still don't have complete proof that it reduces fractures. And there are some studies, and they're small, and I would not say they're definitive, that do not show a benefit, despite the fact that the bones look thicker. I have patients with really thin bones who fall and don't get a fracture. And I ask them about their parents, and their parents never got a fracture. And nobody has anything except familial thin bones. And I think those are people with really great internal bone structure, kind of like the geodesic dome. Remember those? Very little material, very strong. Sometimes it's not how much you've got, but how you deploy it that makes a big difference. In the meantime, high doses of strontium are something that I really think we need to step back from, unless it's the kind that's been clinically proven. We're going to go to our next caller now, and that is David in Santa Cruz. Hello, David. You're on the air.
Well, hello, Dr. Dunn.
Hi.
I was curious about, as a diabetic, the cardiovascular problems that we might have as we get a little older.
All right. That's a really good...
Heart attacks and strokes.
Yeah, that's a really, really good question. And we have to differentiate between type 1 diabetics and type 2 diabetics for this question.
How about for type 2?
All right. So just briefly on type 1 so that we don't neglect a fairly neglected group. People forget about the type 1s when in public health, but the people with type 1 can't make insulin, and they tend to have real broad fluctuations in their blood sugar that can't necessarily be fixed with just good diet, because they have to take insulin or they die. And it's an autoimmune disease, and the insulin-producing cells get destroyed. When we've done all of our studies about long-term risk and all of the hemoglobin A1C stuff, all of that comes from work done on type 1 diabetics. So we have additional studies with respect to heart disease for type 2s that I'll come to in a minute. But with type 1s, what you do is for every year that the person has type 1, you double that in terms of cardiovascular. So if you got type 1 at, say, 20 years old and you're now 40, then your cardiovascular risk is 2 times the 20 years you've had the type 1, and that makes it your risk is the risk of a person who's 60.
Oh, so, my goodness.
So it jumps you down that time curve, and it really is. High blood sugar puts a wear and tear on all of the blood vessels. You know, we think of blood vessels as getting closed because of cholesterol, right? We think of the blockage coming from cholesterol. But there's actually a special kind of diabetic blockage. And the diabetic blockage is actually from a kind of sugar goo, a kind of gel that's primarily glucose that deposits in the arteries underneath the lining of the artery. And so it likes to go into the very small blood vessels, which is why diabetics, but both type 1 and type 2, get problems with the lining, with narrowing of the capillary beds. So that's why they go blind. That's why they have to have amputations, because the capillary beds in the skin get clogged with sugar goo, and then they can't get the red blood cells and the oxygen in there. So they'll get a little paper cut or a blister, and it just won't heal, and eventually it gets infected, and you can't get the white cells in there to fight off the infection. So you get into this situation where amputations are very high in particularly type 1s, but also in very poorly controlled type 2s. But I want to emphasize, amputations are much more common in type 1 than type 2 diabetes. We have, you know, really, unless a person has no care whatsoever and is totally uncontrolled, I don't see a lot of amputations in anyone with any kind, who's on any kind of therapy whatsoever. So I don't want to scare you.
It's probably a threat for homeless people who are not under a doctor's care.
And unfortunately, we have a lot of that, a lot in the United States. And I think if we took all of the people who get last minute, you know, Hail Mary kind of care, and we treated them sooner, that healthcare we'd have an initial front end cost, you know, the investment cost, but then I think the cost of the healthcare system would actually be less than it currently is. And so some of the additional cost of a national healthcare system would be offset by the improved health of the population. I mean, we do have the lowest life expectancy of any advanced industrial nation, and the lowest and the highest infant mortality rates. And that's kind of crazy.
It is crazy. You know, it's disgraceful,
and,
really.
But the reason is access. And so if we fix the access, those things will spontaneously fix, because we do have an excellent infrastructure, and our infrastructure could handle the volume. And things would need to be organized better, and there would be a longer wait for your hip replacement and your knee replacement. Absolutely. But I think, on the other hand, we wouldn't have people with no access to healthcare like we currently do. Do you know, I just learned this, but if you're homeless, you have to have an actual address, and it can't be a post office box to get Medicaid.
Oh, that's terrible.
So, I mean, hello? The people who need it the most are the people who can't access it. And that's just not right. The other thing that I really worry about with diabetics is that many diabetics don't have good controlled blood pressure. And that is a recipe for kidney disease. Talking again about system cost, if you need dialysis, my tax dollars at work. If a person needs dialysis, that is covered by Medicare. It is covered for as long as they survive. And what isn't covered is to go out and do the outreach and control the blood pressure and the blood sugar so that the people don't get the kidney failure. And it's very foolish. And
that's
the kindest word I can say. And I mean, what one has to say to a type 2 diabetic is, we all have a lifetime quota of how much ice cream and how much candy we get to eat. And if you consume all of, it's like you get a trust fund on your glucose consumption. And when you run through your trust fund, you have to stop. You don't have any more glucose tickets or sugar tickets, and you have to cut back. You have to be more controlled. And when people can't do that or are unable to, they begin to damage their body and start looking more and more like a type 2. But if you have diabetes, you've got to control the blood pressure. I mean, everybody out there with diabetes, you need a blood pressure cuff. You need to be making sure that your blood pressure's okay. That's really mission critical, because the combination of high blood pressure and diabetes will trash your kidneys. Now, the big blood vessels, the heart, I haven't covered the heart yet, and I haven't covered the strokes. So cholesterol goes up with type 2 diabetes, usually. And that's because insulin turns off your ability to digest fat. And so your body can't process fat, so it goes into storage, and some of that gets indirectly converts into cholesterol. The insulin's inflammatory, so that directs the cholesterol to go into the artery, because it's only oxidized LDL, one little component of cholesterol is the only kind that can get into the artery. And that one gets into the artery when it's inflamed, when there's infection, or when there's inflammation, or when there's high levels of insulin. So it's a real vicious cycle. And what do we do with diabetics? Well, often, and I do this too, I give them insulin because I've got to get the blood pressure under control. I mean, the blood sugar under control. And I give them insulin. I know that that insulin is potentially inflammatory, and I know that that's going to cause them to accumulate fat, but I've got to get that blood sugar out of their bloodstream and into their cells. And so the best thing to do is not eat a lot of sugar at the front end, because our fixes are not really fixes. They're patches. And, you know, it's better to if you're in a leaky rubber raft, I mean, you can slap an emergency patch on it, but you really want to get out of the water.
Well, that's very useful. Thank you very much, Dr. Don.
And thank you so much for the call, David.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
So another email, this one from James in Santa Fe. And James writes, your show is great. Thank you for giving so much back to us around the world. Parenthetically, folks, I've been doing the show and podcasting it over the last couple of years to make sure that I kept at least some of my remote audience and that they had a lifeline. James continues, I had a disc injury in my lower back. Ultimately, it healed without surgery, but in the months following, I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia. None of the docs seem to have a good answer as to why I feel so much pain in my thoracic cage area, except to suggest maybe trigger points is the cause. What I've noticed over the years is how quickly and terribly my middle back pain comes back whenever I am standing or sitting upright, and whenever I stretch out my arms. I also can't drive in the upright position. I must be reclined quite a bit, not to be in bad pain. And once that pain hits, I often start feeling lightheaded and disoriented to the point where I can't tolerate light or noise. Do you feel there could be something structurally amiss at play here? I don't get any real numbness or tingling. Oddly enough, when I'm at the grocery store, I am comfortable leaning forward on a carriage, but don't seem to present with any other indicators of stenosis. So thank you so much. James, you need a scan, dude. I really am concerned about something structural going on in that spine. And the thing about the lightheadedness and the disorientation is I'm wondering if something is actually putting pressure on your sympathetic nervous chain. Now, certainly severe pain will sometimes cause that, because it causes a vagal reaction. But the first thing you have to do is exclude the possibility that the individual may have a structural abnormality. And when you have a positional pain like this, that needs to be checked. It is possible that you have disc disease or severe arthritis in your thoracic spine, although that is unusual. You have the disease in your lower spine, so it's plausible. But yes, you absolutely need to get a scan because this is a very atypical presentation. And thank God we have scans and we can get a good look in there and see what's going on. And I believe that if you ask your primary care doctor for a referral to a neurologist and particularly emphasize the positioning and the lightheadedness and disorientation aspect of this, I believe that that neurologist will be certain to order a scan if your primary care doctor is unable to do so. Unfortunately, many primary care doctors have had a lot of their prerogatives erased in various medical systems, and they now need to, basically ask permission for what I consider to be normal medical practice. And that's sad, but it is what it is. Intermittent fasting works for people with chronic inflammatory disorders. So I wanted to talk to you about this because intermittent fasting has been in the very much a hot topic for a while now, and I certainly get lots of questions about it at the office. So let's first define our terms. An intermittent fasting is something like 16 hours or less, so 12 to 16 hours. Ideally, if you have inflammation, let's say you have psoriasis or you have inflammatory disorders, if you have a high HSCRP and you can't seem to get it down, if you're a type 2 diabetic like David and you're not on insulin, because you really can't do this if you're on insulin, but if you're a type 2, this works really well. If you're not on insulin and the only pharmaceutical you're taking is metformin, because that's the only safe one, because it doesn't drop your blood sugar. So people can do this under those circumstances, even with type 2 diabetes. But when you don't eat for 12 to 16 hours, you get a reflex reduction in NF-kappa B, which is the inflammatory genetic signal. So NF-kappa B turns on inflammation in your cells, and you start making a lot of COX-1 and COX-2, cyclooxygenase 1 and 2, and lipooxygenase. And through a miraculous biochemical process, which I will spare you the details of, the surface of your cell wall actually gets converted by these compounds into, among other things, prostaglandins. And prostaglandin, the blockage of this creation of prostaglandin is what Motrin and Advil and Aleve are doing. That's how it works. Prednisone, which is also a very strong anti-inflammatory but has very major side effects and can't be taken long-term without damaging the body, blocks it higher up on the chain. It prevents NF-kappa-B from being released. Well, that's what fasting does. So what I'm telling you is that intermittent fasting works as well as prednisone for reducing inflammation in people with chronic inflammatory disorders. So if you can collapse what you eat, if you can collapse this down to 1 8-hour period a day where you consume all of your calories, and that's tough, and our society mitigates against it, but if you do that for a week, you will know whether your inflammation is being affected. Because if it works, you will be less achy and your joints will be more fluid, and your skin, if it's rosacea or a skin inflammation, even psoriasis can respond to this. But we know that caloric restriction does all kinds of great things, but you don't have to fast for 2 or 3 days. You don't have to fast for 24 hours out of every week. That's truly hard. And for older people, I don't recommend that. I think that's too difficult. If you've been doing it all your life, then your epigenetics are primed for it, and fine. If you're a Buddhist monk, go you. But if you're someone who's, let's say, 55 or 60, and you decide you're going to get healthy, and so you're going to fast one day a week and only have water, you're pushing the envelope, and you may live to regret it. Just a few other anti-inflammatories that I use all the time in my medical practice, which work at this level to decrease NF-kappa-B: curcumin, olive oil. And you know how much olive oil? Well, there's a study that they did where they gave people a big bottle of olive oil, and they say, finish this in a week. So we're talking a couple of ounces, maybe three or four ounces of olive oil a day in those individuals. But these are also people who are not eating a lot of sugar. Curcumin, which comes from turmeric, it's the active ingredient. But I like to use extracts because turmeric is very poorly absorbed. Even if you throw black pepper in there, you still need to take a lot of turmeric to get enough curcumin to reduce NF-kappa-B. Quercetin, I already mentioned that. With the allergies, same dose, 1 to 3 grams. And green tea extract. And also pomegranate is good, but the sweetened pomegranate I'm not so down with, because you're doing the cha-cha, one step forward, one step back, when you include a lot of sugar. 2 ounces of a pomegranate juice in water over the course of a day, that's probably about the right dose. I was reminded of something today by another patient, and that something was about a drug called amiodarone. Amiodarone is an antiarrhythmic drug. One of the people I saw today had been placed on it by their cardiologist to treat atrial fibrillation. And indeed, it is a good drug to stabilize heart rhythm. But I want to point out kind of a blind spot that people who are prescribing prescription medicines have, which is if you go into a regular doctor and you tell them that you're taking 2 milligrams of iodine a day, they'll freak out. They'll say, oh, that's too much. And look, the RDA for iodine is only 150 micrograms. You're taking more than 10 times the RDA. And you should probably stop that. That could suppress your thyroid. Amiodarone has 300 micrograms of iodine in every dose. So if a person's taking that every day, then they're going to be getting a pretty substantial increase in iodine in their body. They're going to be getting 3 milligrams a day, and they're going to be getting it long term. So I think we have to say, if we've got a pharmaceutical that is giving 3 milligrams of iodine a day, we can probably assume that that's an okay dose because it went through the FDA and la, la, la. It's drug approved. It's been out forever. It's even generic. So it's more than 17 years that it's been around. And we haven't killed anybody's thyroid if they didn't already have a thyroid issue. So all I'm saying is we can relax about iodine a little bit. And I like iodine. I put anyone who's had breast cancer or breast dysplasia or has fibrocystic breasts on iodine because it's protective. And there's good science that shows that it shrinks fibrocystic breast disease, that it shrinks breast nodules. It doesn't cure breast cancer, but it helps with benign breast disease, and it may be protective. There are definitely studies that show it has a protective benefit for prevention of both breast cancer as a primary and also for recurrence of breast cancer. So maybe we need to relax a little bit on iodine. After all, I talked about that earlier when I was talking philosophy. And in Japan, it's not unusual to get three times that much iodine every single day. So I have to ask myself, are we only worried about iodine when it comes from a health food store, but we're not worried about it when it comes from a pharmacy? And isn't that kind of an inconsistency? This is just not really a scientific article, but a really good one about the topic of the internet and vaccination. So The Guardian, which is a British newspaper, looked at the top 12 vaccine-related Facebook groups, and they were all anti-vax. Okay, no surprise there. 8 of the top 12 pages returned by Facebook's search engine contained anti-vax vaccine. They are saying propaganda here. I'm not going to use that word. Opinions. YouTube autofill suggestions recommended videos that routinely steer users to anti-vaccination content. Okay, that's where the robot is doing us a disservice. If I type in vaccination and the top 20 videos are all anti-vaccine, that's not what the search engine should be doing. It should be balanced, but instead it's based on volume. Do we really want to crowdsource our scientific information? I think we will be crowdsourcing our measles epidemics and possibly our polio epidemics. You know, polio could come back. All kinds of things could come back if we get really hysterical on the subject of vaccination. They also found that Russian bot and troll accounts virally spread anti-vaccine content and also pro-vaccine content as part of their effort to sow political discord in the United States. And they did that a lot in 2016 during the presidential election. So, you know, we have to stop and say to ourselves, is the internet the right place? Are the rankings that we're seeing anything more than a popularity contest? And do we just want to back up and vet the site and ask, are they selling anything? If they are, what are they selling? Is this clickbait? Buyer beware, reader beware, and surfer beware. Okay, we're going to go to Rod in San Francisco. Hello, Rod, you're on the air. And how are you?
I'm doing very good. And thank you for being there. I have a question that is a follow-up on your discussion about diabetes and clogging of microcapillaries.
Go ahead.
I've heard the hypothesis that many of our aging difficulties come from the capillaries getting clogged up, and I'm aware of at least one person trying to sell a remedy to fix this, which consists, as far as I can tell, primarily of strong antioxidants. Do you have any knowledge of this?
Well,
what it is, I don't know whether aging is in fact primarily caused by capillary problems.
Well, aging is not primarily caused by capillary problems.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
But oxidative stress is a major cause of aging. And that's everything from cosmic rays blowing through your cells to the fact that every time you eat, the process of digestion, the very process of creating ATP reduces free radicals, which need to be quenched. I call it the sparks in the blacksmith shop. If you are in, if you have a wood floor in that blacksmith shop, you definitely wet it down so that it doesn't catch fire when you start striking away on the anvil. And those sparks are necessary for the process, but you want to quench them right away. And that's what the antioxidants do. So having high levels of cellular antioxidants is effectively a partial remedy to aging. Unfortunately, other things happen. The telomeres, the little shoelace tips on the cells also degrade. And there's just plain wear and tear that can't be, that doesn't seem to be able to be repaired. Structural changes in the vasculature. And ultimately things wear out, but antioxidants help them not wear out as quickly. And, you know, we have a very polluted environment, lots of oxidative stress from trying to get rid of the stuff that we consume. So super important for us to take our antioxidants. So I'm not against a strong antioxidant thing. I think they're over-promising there. And my first thing would be, okay, what's your data for making that statement? Do you actually have some science with your product on an animal model that shows extension of life expectancy? That's not so hard to get, although you do have to put some money into it. So that's what I want to see. I want to see that kind of data. And if not for the product, then for everything that's in the product. And I'd like to see that, you know, included in the literature, at least on the reference page of the thing. By the way, there's a lot of Trojan references out there.
Yeah.
So you have to actually follow look at the reference. So you put it into the browser and you look and see whether in fact the article A exists and B is actually researching what they are purporting to say it says. And often it's a Trojan reference. We're going to have to sign off now, but thank you so very much. And call and please keep listening.
Yeah. Thanks for being there.
Bye. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.